The EU foreign policy chief says that there is not sufficient support from all member states for an embargo on Russian energy imports. Washington says it will boost its military support for Ukraine as the U.S. Secretary of State and Defense visit Kyiv. And Emmanuel Macron vows to unite France and address the anger of voters after being re-elected as French president. World News, I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. The top story this hour, the European Union remains divided over an embargo on Russian energy imports as the bloc is looking to impose a sixth package of sanctions against the Kremlin. EU Foreign Affairs Chief Josep Borrell says that there is not sufficient support from all member states for full sanctions against Russian oil and gas. He said that all EU countries are working to cut their dependency on Russian energy imports, so the ban will happen at some point. Some EU members, including Germany, oppose an immediate embargo on Russian energy. Berlin says a sudden cutoff will send all of Europe into a recession. The bloc is set to hold a summit at the end of this month to further discuss the issue. A top EU diplomat has said that the Union is preparing smart sanctions against Moscow to maximize pressure on it while minimizing damage to the bloc. The protests erupt in the French capital after incumbent Emmanuel Macron wins the Sunday runoff presidential vote. Voters who backed Macron's far-right contender Marine Le Pen gathered in central Paris after she was beaten with a comfortable margin of 16%. Clashes erupted after police fired tear gas at the ralliers. Police also shot two people dead and injured one. They were shot after their vehicle failed to stop. Meantime, Le Pen has admitted defeat but has promised to continue the fight. European leaders were quick to congratulate Macron. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said that a 27-nation bloc can count on France for five more years. And German Chancellor Olaf Scholz said Macron's re-election is a vote of confidence in Europe. Well, I've asked journalist and political analyst Elijah Magner about whether French President Macron will be able to solve the problems that people are dealing with during his second term in office. Let's take a listen to him.
The real problem is exactly identified by President Emmanuel Macron himself when he said that he knows that a large number of French people did not vote for him to support him, but to prevent Marine Le Pen from reaching the power. Therefore, many people don't want him, and that was manifested in the first round when he got only 27%. So all the rest that he got between 27 and 58 is the difference that other group choose Macron because he was the less bad than Le Pen, because he failed to fulfill his program. He failed all the domestic issues that are most important for the French population rather than international policy.
Time now for the news review program. U.S. Secretaries of State and Defense say that Washington is increasing its military support for Ukraine.
They need long-range fires. You've heard them express a need for tanks. And we are doing everything that we can to get them the types of support, the types of artillery and munitions that will be effective in this stage of the fight. We're going to push as hard as we can, as quickly as we can, to get them what they need.
What I'm seeing, at least, is that aid is getting here and other distribution points. It's getting out the door incredibly quickly. Again, this place is going to look different 5 or 6 hours from now than it does right now.
Antony Blinken and Lloyd Austin made a comments near the Ukrainian border in Poland. They visited Kyiv on Sunday night and met with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. During that meeting, the two officials pledged more than $700 million in additional direct and indirect military aid. They also cited U.S. President Joe Biden as saying that American diplomats would return to Ukraine as soon as this week. That was the highest level visit by U.S. officials to Ukraine since the beginning of the war with Russia on February 24th. Let me now invite our guests and see what they think about this issue and explore different aspects of it. So Greg Simons, researcher for the Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies, joining me from Uppsala, Sweden. Also with us, we'll have Bijan Tavassili, who is a political analyst in Hamburg. Good to see you, gentlemen. Now, Greg, the U.S. has been offering support since day one when this war started. So what's the purpose behind this? Does the U.S. really want, do they care about the lives lost on both sides, especially the Ukrainians that they seemingly they pretend to care about? Is this going to kind of prolong the war or put an end to it?
This is the intention. The rhetorics suggest that it's to end the war. I mean, of course, one just needs to look back in Syria. They used exactly the same, talked about opposition to fight the Syrian government. So you have a similar strategy here in terms of communication. It's not going to change the ultimate outcome of the war, but what they want is a long war, because U.S. officials have stated from the beginning they want an Afghan-like scenario for the Russians. That's what destroy Russia's geopolitical power and influence, not only in Ukraine, but Europe more widely. So that this is a very dangerous that they're playing so-called emergence of a so-called multipolar world order.
Okay, Bijan, how do you look at this?
Yeah, I think we're now clearly exceeding the bounds of proxy war, because in a proxy war, you don't supply artillery, you don't supply tanks. We have seen the United States support ISIS in Syria and many other terrorist groups around the world, but they never gave them tanks. You know, this is another dimension. And so they are openly waging war against Russia now, something that would have been unthinkable since the advent of the Cold War. And so we are really seeing a danger of this escalating into a wider war between NATO countries and the Russian Federation, which is incredibly dangerous, because what the Americans, maybe they seem to actually relish in the prospect of, is the use of tactical nuclear weapons on the European battlefield.
Okay, gentlemen, let's take a look at some social media reactions, and then I'll come back to you with more questions. Now, the first post goes, USA is hoping to enjoy prolonging the war to make Russia suffer, but for Ukrainians, it will be hell for them. I know Ukraine will be able to rebuild itself after the war, but it won't be able to bring back the lives of the lost ones. Another one says that, what's the end game here, especially for the U.S.? Why are we paying for this? The citizens, we just got out of Iraq, Afghanistan, now this. We have terrible roads, no free textbooks, no free college, high healthcare costs, high housing, etc. Yet we have money for war. It's all futile. Another one says that if America, with all its advanced weapons and soldiers, cannot defeat the Taliban in Afghanistan, is it possible for Ukraine to defeat Russia with American weapons? Terry Morris says that there is no profit in peace. Ukraine's proxy war, a potential global catastrophe through Zelensky's naivete and Azov neo-Nazi hotheads, is too good for an earner for U.S. arms suppliers for them to drop easily. U.S. interests? Profit and hegemony. And then another post goes that all that $322 million to Lockheed Martin, Boeing, and Honeywell. A promise was fulfilled by Biden for electing him. Now back to our guests. Greg, maybe we could ask one of these about one of these comments here, that what's the end game here, especially for the U.S.? And don't they have more important issues at home, on the home turf, to address? I mean, is this war really, does this outweigh the problems at home?
No, it's a distraction from the problems at home. I mean, the writer of that was absolutely right. The U.S. is crumbling internally. I mean, in all possible aspects. I mean, he mentioned infrastructure and all of these other points, but also it's crumbling in other ways, politically, culturally, socially, etc., economically. And yes, I mean, this war is about their desperate attempt to retain their hegemony. This is not about ordinary people in Ukraine. It's not about ordinary people in the United States. This is about a rather select few people who will profit from war and the misery that results from it.
Mm-hmm. And Bijan, when we look at the economic and business-related consequences and ramifications of this war, and many are blaming the U.S. for, you know, to a large extent, to push this to happen, and it did happen, with Russia warning several times to NATO eastward expansion and all that. And we had the already before the war started in Ukraine, we had energy prices hiking in the U.K. and elsewhere in the EU. Now you have larger consequences. So was it really worth it in the first place?
Well, it certainly was worth it for U.S. defense contractors, for weapons manufacturers, because they get to send weapons to Ukraine and get it be paid by the U.S. taxpayer. They are now supplying NATO countries in Europe with new weapon systems that they never planned on buying, but that the European taxpayers have to pay for now. And they have to pay for this with the new politics of austerity, with reduced social spending, and with higher inflation. And so everyone has to pay more at the pump, fill up their gas tank. They have to pay more when they go to the supermarket and buy their food. And this is really leading to rising discontent in a European and American population that does not want to have anything.
Okay, on that note, we come to the end of this episode of the News Review. Let me thank my guests. We had Greg Simons from Uppsala, Sweden, and Bijan Tavastoli in Hamburg, Germany. Now moving on, people in different countries are taking to the streets to express solidarity with Palestinians who are facing an intensifying Israeli crackdown. In Germany, hundreds of protesters waved the Palestinian flag and carried banners in support of the Palestinian people. Similar events were held in the UK on Sunday. Demonstrators called for international action, including sanctions, to end Israel's growing aggression and occupation of Palestinian territories. Jews also joined the rallies in the British capital, London, and denounced Israeli atrocities and torched the regime's flag. God's Day rallies are also planned to be held in the US, Australia, and Canada. The last Friday of Ramadan is designated as International God's Day. In some countries, the occasion is observed on the last Sunday of the holy month. Iran says the latest round of its talks with Saudi Arabia were positive and progressive. Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said two sides had serious discussions on bilateral regional issues in the Iraqi capital, Baghdad. Said Khatib Zadeh says the negotiations will witness quick progress if they are upgraded to talks between top political officials. The talks were held thanks to efforts by the governments of Iraq and Oman. Discussions were suspended by Iran in March after Saudi Arabia executed 81 men in its biggest mass execution in decades. Multiple bomb attacks on the Hazara community in Afghanistan have left dozens of families in great sorrow. The victims' relatives are calling for justice and an end to the violence. Our correspondent reports from Kabul.
Recent deadly attacks in Afghanistan have left Afghan families grieving. Some have lost their parents, and some their children. Here, we are meeting the family of Shahid Milad, who was killed in Tuesday's school bombing in Kabul. Milad's mother can't speak, as she is in a flood of tears, mourning the loss of her young son. But his disabled father managed to speak with great sorrow.
Milad was a very diligent boy. It was his last year at school. He was preparing himself to enter university. He used to tell me that he was going to become a doctor and make a living so that his father doesn't have to work. He wished to serve his family and society, but unfortunately they took him from us.
In another alley in Hazara neighborhood, another family is mourning the death of a father. After the attack on the school students, Mir Hussein went to bring his son home. But he himself fell victim to the second explosion.
My brother was on the roof when he heard a bomb explosion at the school. He quickly went to school to find his son Mahdi. He was searching around when the second explosion occurred. He was injured in the attack, but later at the hospital, we lost him forever.
Mahdi has survived the attack, but he is struggling with the shock of the attack and the pain of losing his father. Likewise, in the west of Kabul, there are many families whose beloved ones are either killed or wounded. They feel despaired and can't hold back their tears. It remains to be seen if the time can heal their wounds. These days, Afghan families want peace and security. People here say they're terrified of repeated blind terror attacks. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The Holy Shrine of Imam Reza in Iran's Mashhad city has hosted a large-scale Ramadan iftar meal. The event is part of the shrine's annual charity work organized during the fasting months of Ramadan. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
World Quds Day, auguring end of Israel. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. This year's World Quds Day arrives while the cause of Palestine is facing four main issues. Some Arab regimes have increased efforts to normalize their ties with the usurper Zionist regime. The fake Zionist regime has escalated brutality against Palestinian defenseless people. Brave Palestinians have increased martyrdom-seeking operations against criminal Zionist military, and horror has covered the entire structure of the Zionist security apparatus. Some of the Arab regimes led by the United Arab Emirates continue betraying the Palestinian cause through normalizing of ties with the occupying Zionist regime. A few days before the blessed month of Ramadan, two meetings were held in the presence of Israeli and Arab officials in the Egyptian Sharm el-Sheikh and Negev desert of the occupied Palestine. The point to note is that the Arab and Zionist officials met in the occupied territories for the first time. It was quite clear that the fabricated regime was pursuing political and economic goals through normalization of ties with the Arab regimes. Politically speaking, the regime strives to relieve itself from isolation in West Asia, Last year, Israel tried to deceive a number of Arab regimes, but the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan were the only regimes which betrayed the Quds cause in normalization of ties with the criminal regime. Economically, the Zionist regime has made efforts to normalize ties with Arab regimes to get rid of the economic pressures through selling weapons to Arab countries. In view of this, the Ministry of War of Israel announced on April 13th that in 2021, 7% of the defense exports worth $791 million have been sent to the countries which had signed Abraham Agreement. Concurrent with the strengthening of ties with the Zionist regime by a few Arab regimes, the child-killing regime has considerably escalated crimes against the defenseless civilians in Palestine. The UN Humanitarian Affairs Office announced that in 2021, 496 attacks were registered against Palestinians by Israeli settlers. 370 of these attacks have resulted in financial damages and 126 have led to human loss against Palestinians. This, while the number of attacks in 2020 was 385. The Palestinian Statistics Center announced that in 2021, 17 Palestinian children in the West Bank and 61 children in the Gaza Strip were martyred by the Zionist criminal military. However, since the start of 2022, the regime's criminal forces have killed 37 Palestinians. The number of Palestinian detainees has also surpassed 1,100 in the current year. The Committee for Support of Palestinian Prisoners has also announced that more than 200 Palestinians have been arrested by Zionist military since April 1st. The Palestinian people have chosen resistance as the only way against the crimes of the Zionist regime. They have carried out four martyrdom-seeking operations since late March, during which at least 14 Zionist criminals have been killed. The first operation killed two, the second two, the third killed five, and the fourth operation killed three Zionist criminals. The point to note is that the geographical expansion of the operations, which covers Negev Desert in south up to Al-Khasire in the north, and from there to the heart of Tel Aviv, four consecutive operations are very strategic, especially when all of them take place in 1948 territories. The martyrdom-seeking operations have seriously challenged the security apparatus of the Zionist regime. Yitzhak Herzog, president of the fabricated Israeli regime, said on April 14th that the operations of Palestinians are dangerous. He was so scared that he suggested negotiations with Palestinians as a way for interaction. Meanwhile, the Zionist regime cabinet announced that a 40-kilometer wall will be built to prevent what is called as threats. The regime had implemented similar projects in the past too. The child-killing regime raised the project of constructing barrier wall around the occupied territories in 1992. 8 years later, in 2004, the International Court of Justice issued an order to demolish the wall, which was not paid attention by Tel Aviv, and it continued to construct it. In 2002, too, the construction of another barrier wall began upon the order of the butcher of Sabra and Shatila and the super-criminal Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Another barrier wall, which has been built in 2010 by the regime, was the one on the Egyptian border to prevent the arrival of migrants from the Sinai Desert. In 2015, too, the fake regime built a barrier wall on the Jordanian borders. Zionists started the project of the fourth wall in 2015 on the Syrian borders and the occupied Golan Heights. The fifth wall has started on Gaza borders with the aim of restricting infiltration of the Palestinian combatants. The Zionist regime has started the construction of the sixth wall on the Lebanese borders in 2017. The wall is 6 meters high. The fabricated criminal regime of Israel has indeed put itself in a cage by building several walls. These walls will just persuade Palestinians to insist on their legitimate rights till the ultimate liberation of the entire Palestine and the expulsion of all occupiers.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It was a hugely anticipated ceasefire followed by a truce coming after 7 years of the Saudi onslaught, the truce being 2 months in duration, it was supposed to be. It was an opening for a political solution that seemed to have taken place, but Saudi Arabia could not keep its end of the bargain. After not opening Sana'a International Airport based on the ceasefire agreement, it was allowed to have one flight a week, but then it reneged on that also. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how this may spell the end of the Yemeni truce, and what chances there are for this truce to take shape in order to move into the political process. Well, let's find out more about what has occurred. Abdul Latif Shali is our correspondent who joins us from Yemen's capital, Sana'a. So what is the explanation that's been given at this point for this one flight a week, even for that to not happen?
Thank you so much. The Yemenis, since the beginning of this UN brokered truce, they have been knowing that the Saudi coalition will not commit or obey to the terms of the agreement. They said that the Saudi coalition is maybe trying to rearrange its ranks during this period of time, and they are now trying to just keep detaining the Yemeni fuel ships and also obstructing all the flights were supposed to be coming and getting out of Sana'a airport. Today, patients were in the airport in the morning, and they were surprised that the Saudi coalition stopped this flight also, which is only one flight per week, and it's not even enough to help a few hundreds of people during the truce. Now it has passed almost 3 weeks, and the Yemenis did not use the airport. It was supposed to be opened since the first day of the truce, according to the agreement. And unfortunately, Saudi Arabia is only doing everything to undermine the truce. The spokesman of the Ansarullah movement, Muhammad Abdul Salam, said earlier that the Saudi troops in Marib have conducted a few raids on the city and also have conducted a few military operations against the Yemeni army, but the Yemeni army did not do anything to save the agreement and also to make peace over the country. But unfortunately, the Saudis and all the troops inside the country are trying only to provoke the Yemeni army to launch further operations, whether inside the country or even against Saudi targets. But I believe if they kept just doing this and kept not obeying to the terms of the truce, the Yemeni army will absolutely launch operations, not only here and inside the country, but also against maybe Saudi targets, and also Emirati targets will be included in the coming attacks.
Okay, so two key questions before I let you go. First, did they say until further notice? Did they give a date of when the flights would resume? And second key question here, you talked about the reaction by the Yemeni government. They've come out and said they're going to target either UAE or continue with the war. How much time frame did they allow to pass before they started their military operations or restart their military operations?
Two fuel ships are still detained by Saudi Arabia. Sana'a Airport is not opened until the moment. 3 weeks have passed until the moment and nothing happened. So the truce is with no benefit for the Yemeni people. Why would the Yemeni people keep telling the Yemeni government, the National Salvation Government, to keep holding this truce? They will absolutely demand the Yemeni army, what they will demand the National Salvation Government to do something to provoke the Saudis or to stop the Saudis from detaining Yemeni oil vessels or opening Sana'a Airport. You know, the last attack against Aramco in Jeddah, that was what Yemenis believe that was the reason behind this truce. And if the Yemeni army have launched further attacks like that one in Jeddah, maybe also inside Emirati territories, this will push the kingdom and also the UAE to stop their war against the Yemeni people and lift the blockade. So now 3 weeks have passed and the truce is only for 2 months. So I don't know, maybe it will be for another week or 2 weeks until the Yemeni army say that the truce is with no benefit for the Yemeni people, and also that the Saudis and the Emiratis did not obey to the terms of the truce.
Thank you very much for that. That's Abdullah Latif Al-Bushali, our correspondent there from Sana'a. Okay, let me introduce our guests for this edition of the Spotlight. Hamza Karim is a Yemeni writer and activist who joins us from Toronto. Also joining us is Brian Terrell, a political commentator and peace activist who joins us from Molloy, Iowa, I believe.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, great. Welcome to you both. Hamza Karim, let me first start with you. What is going on? You have this indefinite postponement for the flights coming out of Sana'a International Airport, which is the first in 7 years. And you have what was supposed to have been a flight to take, not for recreational use, passengers who needed medical care. So now the permit has been refused to be issued, which is a violation of this two-month truce. Why do you think this has happened?
I truly believe that Saudi Arabia, they don't have serious intentions in committing to any peace, agreements or even this truce that was supposed to last for 2 months. We've seen in the past, for the past 7 years, there have been some truces in place, but really Saudi Arabia wasn't serious about them. Now, what Saudi Arabia is saying is that the main reason that they haven't issued the permit is because, they're asking that all the passports for the passengers should be issued from Aden, which is controlled by them. And then the second issue I think that they're having is that most of the passengers that want to leave Yemen are, the war-wounded survivors. So, these are only excuses used by Saudi Arabia to continue blockading Yemen and increasing the suffering of Yemeni people. The truce for the past 3 weeks, we've seen, military actions have been are still taking places in various provinces like Marib, Hajja, and Saada. There have been over 100 violations since yesterday. The port, the Al-Hudaydah port, is not fully unblockaded. We have two oil ships that are still held by Saudis at Al-Hudaydah Airport or Jazan Port. They're held there, and they have over 10,000 tons of oil and gas that is really needed by Yemeni people to resume and live a normal life, needed by hospitals, needed by by the cars, needed for transportation, needed by factories. So far, what we've seen is that Saudi Arabia really are not committed to the truce, or are not willing to go further to resume peace talks.
Brian Terrell, something's not making sense here. When you take a look at when the truce was announced, and, you know, it's not a truce that is the first time that was announced. You know, we've had truce announcements before. And this was followed by certain political steps also that we're going to get into in a bit. But we're having on multiple occasions Saudi-led coalition to have broken the truce. The airport, one instance, then you have the, what we understand, positions in Marib of the Yemeni armed forces to have been targeted. You have oil tankers that are being impounded. And it was announced on April the 2nd, and here we are. It's just a little over 3 weeks old. Why do you think Saudi Arabia is committing these violations?
Yeah, it's 3 weeks into this, and, you know, we've said it over and over again for so many years that this is a human catastrophe. This is an emergency, and it ought to be dealt with as an emergency. And the food, the situation now in Yemen with, exacerbated by the war in Ukraine, which provides 40% of Yemeni wheat. And now the food prices, just since this war started, has gone up 150% in Yemen, where most people can't afford the food and couldn't afford the food to begin with. So, no, there's not goodwill here, and there's not goodwill on the part of the United States either. President Biden, as a candidate, parroted what everybody else is saying about the disaster of the war in Yemen and how barbaric it is and how it has to stop, and pledged U.S. cooperation with the Saudi effort would end. And in the first year of the Biden presidency, more than $1 billion worth of missiles sold to the Saudis. Now, we're also seeing I'm really happy to see that there's now a new effort by some people in the U.S. Congress to make a War Powers Resolution Act to stop the United States from cooperating with the Saudis. And this is something that the Democrats have done before. When Trump was president, and knowing that Trump would veto such a bill, and he did when it was passed. And now the Democrats largely are not behind this, and I think it's because it will force Biden into a situation where he'd have to either pass or veto such a bill. So yeah, and what's happening at the airport is like the idea that because some of the passengers don't carry passports from the Aden government, which in almost any way you want to look at it, doesn't exist anymore. You know, right after early this month, the President Hadi was dismissed or stepped down, replaced by a presidential leadership council. It's a government that doesn't really exist, and any kind of negotiations, any real negotiations, with Yemen has to include the government that is actually in power, whether people like it or not. The Nasrallah government is the government of Yemen. And there can't be any resolution without recognizing that and recognizing their passports, being able to talk at high levels with them. It's absurd to think that any steps forward can be made without that.
All right. Well, let's since you mentioned the U.S. and at the end there you're talking about that presidential council. Let's talk about the U.S. If we can, Hamza Karim. I'm looking at the statement made very recently by the U.S. President Joe Biden on this, of which he has said that he has welcomed the agreement, but he said the terms of the ceasefire was just the first step. Again, I'm looking to see where this went wrong. Do you think that there was any kind of pushback by the U.S., change of mind by the U.S., then relate to Saudi Arabia? Because we know that the U.S. is trying to, one way or another, whether Joe Biden likes it or not, trying to claw its way back into the Saudis' liking, based on some reports. Do you think maybe the U.S. instigated a change of mind on the part of Saudi Arabia?
Absolutely. I think Saudi Arabia in this war they haven't been really driving or leading this war. We all know that Saudi Arabia can't make any moves, especially like these big moves, without a green light from the U.S. administration. Now, if we all remember, this truce came after the attack that happened in Aramco in Jeddah, and we all know that back then and even now, U.S. cannot stand seeing the gas prices going up and do nothing about it. The war in Ukraine right now is already driving the prices of gas up, and they can't take seeing the prices going even more. So I think there was some pressure on Saudi Arabia to really at least absorb some of the anger that is happening in the international community and inside Yemen because of this war, really rearrange themselves in Yemen and trying to get all the groups that are fighting for Saudi Arabia and UAE and US together and really get their ducks in a row to go back to this war again. For me, I don't see US really being very serious about stopping this war in Yemen. If they were very serious about it, they would have, stopped selling arms to Saudi Arabia. They would have really just stopped providing them with all the intelligence and the logistics to continue this war. But so far, we haven't seen any serious steps or taking place by the U.S. So definitely, U.S. is not happy and are not willing to really stop this war. We haven't seen any serious actions. So I definitely agree that since the beginning of this truce, Saudi Arabia and U.S. weren't serious. They were just trying to buy some time to get their ducks in a row, to rearrange themselves, and to go back into this war.
Okay, well, let's go through the motions here as to where this stood in terms of the Presidential Leadership Council, Brian Terrell. On April 7th, this was sworn in before the parliament in Aden, okay, and there they announced that they were going to negotiate with the Ansarullah movement for a permanent ceasefire, which then we were looking at the two-month ceasefire that came into, or truce, that was announced. And then we went through that show about Hadi transferring powers to the council. Of course, many are deducting that the Saudi Crown Prince fired him, pretty much. But then we're looking at the representation of power, where there's an equal distribution of power between the countries north and south. And then you have the council, which includes the prominent leader of the SDC, the Southern Transitional Council, supported by Saudi Arabia and also as coalition part of the UAE. I went through this in order to ask you whether there was a change of heart or something that did not now stand well with Saudi Arabia in terms of the composition of the Leadership Council or the way that this went down. What do you think?
No, I really don't know about that. I think what's interesting is the Hadi government was the reason that the justification that the Saudi Arabia gave to begin with to be in Yemen at all in the first place. So with that gone, it kind of takes the chair out from under the Saudis and their excuse. I think that there is a there is a fear that the Saudis have and the United States has that peace might break out, and if this Presidential Leadership Council shows any promise of really negotiating, with the Houthi government and really coming to an end to this this war and this horrible starvation, that will be stopped. That will not be tolerated by the Saudis or the United States. This is a cash cow, and the rising of the gas prices, as our friend said, is a very big issue here. While the gas prices are going up, the profits for the oil companies are going up too. So the anger needs to be assuaged, but we don't want to start bringing the prices down either. The planet is in really bad shape, and we're in danger of catastrophic climate change. And all this time, all these these months that should be used, the research, the resources that should be put into finding alternatives to fossil fuels, instead are going toward this war. And we're seeing in the United States the Biden administration is not only allowing for more permits to drill and to frack, you know, to use U.S. Oil and gas to counteract what's being boycotted from with the Russians.
Right.
We're putting everything is being set back, and the world is being put. You know, we need to do something very, very different.
Sure.
We need to do it quick. The people of Yemen are suffering, and they're dying now. And mass starvation is real. But the whole planet needs the Saudis and the United States and everybody, the Russians, to change its course.
Sure. Well, this Presidential Leadership Council, Hamza Karim, I'm curious as to whether this was going to work anyways. Because if you want to take a look at the way that the leadership was going to be, it was very murky as to what type of influence could the Saudi side have when we know on the ground it is the Ansarullah currently and the Yemeni government who have the support from the people. I mean, who does Saudi Arabia have or can put in place there for any type of reconciliation to happen? That's always been a big question mark.
Yeah, just to give you a bit of background about this Presidential Leadership Council. So what Saudi Arabia did alongside with UAE, and backed by the U.S., of course, is trying to group all the groups in ground in Yemen that had problems and even fought and killed each other in the past. There are some groups who are aligned with the UAE. Some of them are aligned with Saudi Arabia. So what they tried to do is put all these groups together. Now, these groups, the members of these groups, they all have power in ground, except for the president of this of the Presidential Leadership Council. But so what they're trying to do is basically get all these groups together and make them sit down and really work as a team. But we've seen this for the past 7 years. This did not work. These groups, they fought with each other. They killed each other in Aden, in Marib, in Shabwa, in many provinces. And but I think there is some kind of pressure now on them to come together and work under one leadership. But I don't think this is going to work because all these groups have their own agendas. They all have their own plans. They want to they want to control some certain areas in Yemen. And it's very hard to bring them all together under one umbrella and put a one leadership for them all. So in my opinion, I don't see this is working because, you know, they all have different agendas. They all have different objectives. They all have different visions. And it's very hard to put them all together in one table.
Well, then what are we looking at, Brian Terrell, if this thing falls apart, which is unfortunately going in that direction? What type of direction is this thing going to go, which we're looking at the threat that the Ansarullah movement and the Yemeni government has made, is that they're going to again go through targeting Saudi Arabia and the UAE?
Yeah, that's it doesn't look good in this council by the very fact that it was pretty much appointed and put in place by the Saudis means it's going to fail. You know, nothing, you know, the Saudis do not hold the key to solving the problems of Yemen, and neither does the United States. I hate to see it. It looks, as our friend says, it seems inevitable that the Saudi military is going to react as militaries do and as governments do, and under the provocations that it's facing. And it's not going to go well for the people of Yemen either. You know, because the Saudi, the UAE, and the United States, and our different allies are definitely stronger than you know, the Yemenis have proven themselves very bravely and very and used a lot of ingenuity with its limited weaponry, but in the end, by sheer firepower. Yeah, this is not going to be a military solution. It's not going to be a military solution that's imposed by the United States or Saudi Arabia, and it's not going to be a military solution that comes out of the the Ansarullah government either. The promise that this showed of a negotiated end to the war is, as it falls apart, is all the more bitter because in the end, that's the only thing that's going to happen. Someday it's going to happen. And how many people are going to have to die before then? Because there isn't any solution. Nothing will happen unless there's really good faith efforts for all parties to sit down and negotiate an end. And we have not seen any goodwill on the part of the Saudi Arabia or U.S., the UAE, the other coalition partners. It doesn't look good for the near future. We have to, our help has to be a little farther out, and our prayers are with the people of Yemen. And as an American, my apologies are just so heartfelt, and I feel so bad about what our government's been doing to the people of Yemen and people all over the world.
All right, we're going to end it there. We are fresh out of time. Thank you for that, Brian Terrell, political commentator and peace activist. Hamza Karim, thank you, Yemeni writer and activist. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitahwe and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his immaculate progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all around the world, assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from a series of Q&A in Islamic beliefs from IRIB English Radio. Dear brothers and sisters, if you have been following these series of shows, we are trying to answer the doubts and misconceptions on the Islamic beliefs which are received usually in the form of questions from different questioners from around the world. For that, we have again invited a respected scholar, guest of the show, Sheikh Nur Muhammad from Qom Seminary School. Sheikh, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Many thanks for accepting our invitation. It's a great pleasure for us to have you here. The question of the day that we want to ask it from the respected guest, the speaker of the show, Sheikh Nur Muhammad from Qom Seminary Schools, to tell us about committing suicide and its forbiddance from an Islamic perspective. We want to say if it is, can it be permitted in any certain or special cases or not? This is the first part of our questions. A question that we want him to shed some light on. And the second, how can religion and religious teachings prevent us from committing a suicide? I would be glad if you tell us more, Sheikh, in this regard.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Again, this is a very valid question, and it has been frequently asked from the, you know, scholars whether we are allowed to do suicide and practice suicide in certain case or not.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, it has been forbidden according to the Islam and this divine religion.
Mm-hmm.
And no one is allowed to practice suicide by any means and by any excuse.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, the person who commits this crime, the crime of suicide, goes to hell according to the narrations of Ahlul Bayt.
Mm-hmm.
And the punishment of Allah, the chastisement of Allah is waiting for that person.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in any case, as I said, and I just want to repeat myself, by no excuse it has been permitted to commit this crime. And I intentionally call it crime because suicide is one of the grave sins in the religion of Islam. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said that, وَلَا تَقْتُلُوا أَنفُسَكُمْ إِنَّ اللَّهَ كَانَ بِكُمْ رَحِيمًا Chapter Nisa, verse number 29.
Yeah.
He said that, do not kill yourselves. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is most merciful towards you. At least according to one interpretation of the exegetes of the verse of Noble Quran is indicate the forbiddance of committing suicide. I want to say that it is granted according to the religion of Islam and, of course, other religions, because I'm pretty sure that other religions, they forbid having committing suicide. No religion permits having any kind of suicide by no excuse. Because some people say that, for example, I'm suffering from this disaster, I'm suffering from these illnesses, many other excuses. I have financially problems. Or, for example, I lost my, for example, wife or husband. Or, for example, I have a failure in my life. Many other excuses. I cannot tolerate it anymore. Mm-hmm. I just want to commit suicide.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is it permissible then?
It is not acceptable. Mm-hmm. It is not, you know, rationally speaking and according to the, you know, divine verses of Noble Quran, it is not permitted to do that.
Yeah.
Because I just want to add this point that unfortunately it seems that those people, they do not, they are not aware of the philosophy of hardships.
Mm-hmm.
Some people are not aware of that. They do not understand that the philosophy of hardship, whether financially speaking or, for example, health, any other problems occurring to them and conflicting them, it has kind of philosophy behind that. And the philosophy, some part of the philosophy of that is to become closer to the perfected human being, to become closer to your perfection, and to become patient one. Because in the verse of Noble Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said that, وَبَشِّرَ الصَّابِرِينَ, give glad tidings to the patient one. Okay?
Yeah.
And to be patient and to practice patience is one of the most important factors in Islamic teachings. Mm-hmm. You see?
Yeah.
And it actually enacts your potentialities.
So when everything is beyond your capabilities and capacities, Sheikh, what should one do? So you are not able to tolerate any more pressure from the outside that comes to you.
As I said, they have to revise the understanding of the human being. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Yeah.
What is a philosophy of this life? Okay?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I just want to explain the philosophy of life because I have no enough time. But true. Very briefly speaking, the philosophy of this life is to become actually servants of Allah. Servant of Allah means that you become perfected human being.
Yeah.
To enable and to enact your potentialities.
Mm-hmm.
And this perfection, which means to become human being in fullest sense of that. Okay?
Yeah.
And to kind of prepare and to have kind of prosperous life in this world and the hereafter. This is maybe at least one part of the, let's say, philosophy of this life. But for those people who do not understand the meaning of human life, the meaning of humanity, okay, and they do not understand that there is a life after this life, which we call it the Yawmul Qiyamah, which is actually real life, okay?
Yeah.
They do not believe in that. Of course, sometimes they cannot tolerate these difficulties and hardship. I want to say that please look at the biography of some scholars, some divine scholars, okay?
Very true.
There was in a fullest, let's say, hardships, financially speaking, they have some illnesses, okay?
Yeah.
It occurred to my mind the life of the biography of Asad Jamal Gulpaygani, may Allah bless his soul. Please look at the biography. I just want to ask my dear listeners to look at the biography of those mystical, real scholars, okay,
yeah.
Shia scholars. He was in it hardships financially, and he was ill, and many other problems, and please look at his biography. But he said that, I enjoy this life.
Yeah.
Please look at that.
Very true.
Because when I studied that, it was kind of positive energy to me. And he said that, I enjoy this life.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in a bed of illnesses. He was ill. And he was reciting Saifa Sajjadiyya, and he was you know, crying, and he was enjoying talking to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Very beautiful.
And in Farsi, he said that, man khusham, which means that I'm very happy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
Even in that hardships, I'm very happy because I have my relationship to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, perfect, to some extent, I close to my perfection. I have this relationship with Him, with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So I enjoy this life. I want to say that